It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The November general election is less than 3 weeks away. As part of our series of candidate interviews, this morning we talked to Rebecca Clayfish, Republican Lieutenant Governor, who is seeking a third term. She faces Green Party candidate Tiffany Anderson, Libertarian candidate Patrick Baird, Democratic candidate Mandela Barnes, and Independent candidate Will Loesch. Lieutenant Governor Clayfish, good morning and welcome to the Morning Show.
Hi, John. Thanks. How are you?
Well, pretty good so far, but the day is young, as my father always used to say. You've served as Wisconsin's lieutenant governor for two terms. Why are you seeking a third?
Well, we have not solved all of Wisconsin's problems yet, John. As you recall, when we very first asked for these jobs back in 2010, about January, our unemployment rate was at 9.3%. Our biggest challenge as a state was trying to find enough jobs for the people. Today, if you take a look at our totally free Department of Workforce Development job search website, just yesterday I had a group of folks check in front of me. I hadn't looked at the site before I asked them to check. We were at about 101,000 open opportunities and only about 33,000 folks who had posted resumes there. And if you're on unemployment insurance in Wisconsin, you do post your resume there. And so you see, therein lies today's biggest challenge, trying to find enough people for the jobs. The cool part of Governor Walker's incredible success story economically here in Wisconsin is that we've seen the creation of so many jobs. The economy has gotten so much better. Wages are up. Unemployment has been down at 3% or below for the last 7 months straight. But we need to finish the job. We need to make sure that we have enough qualified people to take all of these wonderful opportunities and fully engage everybody who wants to be in the economy, in Wisconsin's economy.
You're running against four other people in this election: Green Party candidate Tiffany Anderson, Libertarian Patrick Baird, Democrat Mandela Barnes, and Independent Will Loesch. What do you bring to the table that they don't?
Well, I think experience, first of all. I've been doing this job for 8 years now, but I also think that, believe it or not, my former careers, both as a journalist and as a media and marketing contractor, are very useful. And I think you could probably see my skills be put to use early on when I started cold calling Illinois businesses to urge them to come to Wisconsin. We've heard a lot of hay being made about the manufacturers and agriculture tax credit. And early in our tenure, that tax credit was so attractive to businesses just over the border, and then also those in Wisconsin who are looking around for a better economic development climate. That tax credit not only caused them to stay, but also allows small businesses to keep more of their own money and farm those dollars back into their companies so that they can grow. So I would argue that having a marketing background and also, you know, being a good listener as a journalist has really helped me a lot. Today, I focus on challenges rather than exclusively economic development, more on the lines of workforce development, because as I mentioned, I think that's probably our biggest challenge today. So a lot of my time is focused on anti-poverty efforts that I think can help engage more people in Wisconsin's economy, because frankly, we can't really have anyone sitting on the sidelines of our talent pipeline today. We really need all hands on deck because we have so many job opportunities. We got a lot of people saying to us, hey, I can't take this extra order, or I can't take on an extra few in my customer base because I'm not going to be able to deliver what they say they need on time. I need more people working for me. And so we need everybody engaged. And so I'm going to continue to focus on those efforts.
Rebecca Clayfish has served as Wisconsin's lieutenant governor since 2011. She is the Republican candidate in this year's gubernatorial election. You mentioned helping people, connect people in poverty with all those jobs that are available. One of the issues that people in impoverished areas have in Wisconsin is getting to and from the job. The jobs aren't where they are. What can we do to improve their transportation options?
Well, I think Foxconn is going to be very unique in thinking far out of the box for transportation solutions. They've talked about everything from a freeway flyer to driverless vehicles, autonomous vehicles, and then they've also even talked about using a rail line that is near them. But I think for the time being, the idea that I have been spending the most time promoting is one that actually doesn't involve government at all. If you've heard of the Joseph Project in both Madison and Milwaukee, you know that this is an organic and natural effort by economic development organizations like Chamber of Commerce and businesses that have gotten simply fed up with not having enough workers in their local area to take their local jobs, so much so that they have decided to band together, buy commuter vans, and essentially gift them to not-for-profit organizations that are training people, build in accountability, and then give them rides, for which they charge to these employers that are especially needy right now. I've seen such tremendous success with the Joseph Project, and I've talked to a number of communities that are considering similar models. It causes the employers to get more skin in the game, but it also, I think, rallies our not-for-profits and our churches, our people of faith, to get more engaged in reaching a hand back and helping someone who may be down on their luck out of what ends up being kind of an economic hole and into a success story and the ability to climb the ladder to your American dream, which is pretty cool.
Mandela Barnes, your Democratic opponent in this race, told us this week that he supports raising Wisconsin's minimum wage above the federal level of $7.25 an hour, saying that corporations in Wisconsin have written the rules for too long. What's your take on Wisconsin's minimum wage?
Well, I've got deep concerns about the $15 minimum wage argument, only because I have seen the data, and I would probably guess that my opponent has as well, that it would cost Wisconsin about 19,000 jobs in one fell swoop. We're also, you know, really reluctant to forget about what it felt like in the recession. I mean, we just came out of it, and though we're doing really, really well, and that feels really terrific, we have the highest unemployment rate among young people post-World War II in that recession. Sorry about the car door. I had to drop Violet off at school. And what we want to make sure is that we still keep our young people engaged in those first jobs, which do tend to be the lower-paying jobs. And I would argue that they probably should be. I don't think that my 15-year-old daughter needs to be making $15 an hour to bus tables at the local restaurant. I think there is value in having a first job, a first experience. And I know that the Wisconsin Restaurant Association alone has said that this would cost Wisconsin nearly 20,000 jobs right off the bat. Besides that, I don't think, John, we want our adults who are supposed to be our family-sustaining wage makers to be taking those minimum wage, $7.25 an hour jobs. I think we need to be a little bit more aspirational than that. I had a conversation 2 days ago with a circuit maker. They said, well, you know what, the unemployment rate is so low, we have seen such incredible wage increases just at our company alone. You know, we went from an $11 an hour starting wage, now we're up to $15 an hour, and we tried a couple of different wages in between. We didn't start to get the type of applicant we wanted until we moved it up to that number. Now, that number seems arbitrary there, but basically what I'm telling you is we're seeing employers move that number up considerably. That's why wages are up in Wisconsin. I think my deeper concern, I would say, not just for Wisconsin, but this entire country, is wage increases being eaten up by health insurance premiums.
Because let's switch to health care as a topic here, Lieutenant Governor. Your running mate, Governor Scott Walker, supports a lawsuit to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which, if it succeeded, would affect coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. Do you also support a repeal of the Affordable Care Act? And if so, what would you replace it with?
John, because I have a pre-existing condition, I am terrified of Obamacare and any sort of socialized medicine that would lead us on the path to what they have in the United Kingdom and Canada, what they proposed for the Oregon Medicaid pilot a few years back. This is because I have a pre-existing condition. When you have finite resources, taxpayer dollars, and you have infinite wants, because we know that when people look at something as free as they have in the UK, there is very little to limit their wants in this regard. There was a wonderful article in Forbes that I'm kind of paraphrasing right now. You run out of money. This is exactly what has happened in the UK, where they canceled 50,000 surgeries this January.
Lieutenant Governor, I'm sorry, we're out of time for this segment. I do appreciate you joining us this morning. I know you're very busy. Rebecca Clayfish has served as Wisconsin's Lieutenant Governor since 2011. She's the Republican candidate in this race. For more information about the Lieutenant Governor's race and everything else on your ballot, visit wisconsinvote.org. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Where the traditional justice system fails victims of sexual assault, a newer approach called restorative justice succeeds. That's according to our guest, who's helped expand it in Wisconsin and beyond. She tells us how it works, and we learn about its intangible effect on survivors. Are you a survivor of sexual assault who used restorative justice to work through the healing process? What was that like? And what part of the process helped you heal the most? Was it an apology, an acknowledgement of your feelings? Why was this helpful? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Join us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet at WPR Mornings. Janine Guskey is a retired Marquette University Law School professor, former director of the Marquette Law School's Restorative Justice Initiative. Janine was previously a justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court and a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge. Janine, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning.
For those who haven't heard about it before, tell us, what is restorative justice?
Well, it is a philosophical approach to trying to heal harm after it's occurred. And more specifically on the area we're discussing today, it's a victim-focused process to help the victim and others around him or her to heal. And so unlike the criminal justice system, where the whole system is geared at figuring out who committed the crime, whether we can prove him or her guilty, and how we're going to sentence that person, this is really figuring out who was harmed, what the nature of the harm was, and hopefully work toward healing. More specifically, I think we're going to talk this morning about one of the processes that are often used in restorative justice, which is victim-offender dialogue. That is, if a survivor is interested, she or he can go through a process where ultimately they can meet with the offender face-to-face and have a dialogue.
Where do we typically see restorative justice applied? Is it mostly in the context of crime, or does it go beyond that?
It clearly goes beyond that. Traditionally, I think in the United States, we've seen it primarily grow in the area of crime. Now the fastest-growing area is in schools. On everything from bullying to truancy and related issues. But I've used it for racial profiling, dealing with issues between police and community. I've used it in unsportsmanlike behavior with athletes and their coaches. We've used it anytime that there's harm, you can use these processes to try to open a dialogue and to be able to have people address some of their concerns. But I want to say on the forefront that all this takes incredible amount of preparation and working with all the parties before you have this dialogue.
Of course, sexual assault and how our system treats it has been top of mind for many Americans lately. So let's talk about how restorative justice can work within that this context. How would that work?
Yeah. Well, and I have done a number of these kinds of cases. Most sexual assault cases are handled post-conviction. That is, after the case has been through the system, an offender has been found guilty and often sentenced to prison. Now, there's no reason it has to have followed that path, but that's how most of them are. The first thing that happens is at some point a survivor makes a decision, and I'm going to use she, although we have male survivors, that she desires to have such a meeting. That's often in conjunction with her therapy. Sometimes it's years and years after the crime, and we will have her into the office to have a discussion with her about why she wants to meet with the offender. Many times it is a desire to look at the offender in the eyes and tell him or her what the harm is that has been caused because of the assault, not just the physical harm, but primarily the psychological harm, which can be immense and irrevocable. Then, after we have that discussion with the victim, and assuming that the victim's motivations are good and she has some questions she wants to ask the offender, there may be some other things, we then go and find the offender and meet with the offender, who's often very surprised that a victim wants to meet with him, and we talk to him about it. If he says, I didn't commit the crime, I wasn't there, it's a bit of the end of the discussion because we don't have these meetings to decide who did it. But if he admits he did something and he was there, even if he mitigates it, we have a discussion with him about the possibility of meeting with a victim. It has to be consensual on all sides. And whatever he says, then we go back to the victim and said, you know, he's going to give you these kinds of answers. Do you still want to meet with him? And we go back and forth between the parties, often for 6 or 9 months before we ultimately have the meeting. And then eventually get to a place where they're both prepared and the facilitator takes the victim to wherever the offender is, and we have a multi-hour dialogue. The primary advantage to all this is those kinds of processes, questions, answers can never happen in the courtroom. I sat in sexual assault court. I saw what happened, and almost always the victim sort of felt out there hanging after the offender was sentenced and never got answers to many of the questions he has. So it gives her an opportunity to get those answers, which often help in the healing process.
So does this cost anything? And if so, who pays?
No, in Wisconsin, our tradition has not been to charge. The ones I do are pro bono. The University of Wisconsin Law School, there's a program run by Jonathan Scheer, who's one of my former students. He works with clinical students. It is also free, so there's no expense to it. We provide this as a service to people.
Is this available statewide or just in Madison? In Madison?
No, we do them statewide. It depends because I'm semi-retired, but so Jonathan's program takes more than I do, and there are a few other facilitators available statewide, but we find who is located closest to where the victim is so that she or he can easily get to meetings with us. And then we travel all over the state because many of these offenders are in prisons all over the state. But both of us have worked in northern Wisconsin and western Wisconsin on particular cases.
So what does restorative justice offer survivors that the traditional justice system doesn't? You alluded to this earlier, but I'd like you to elaborate just a little bit more.
Sure. Well, the first thing is it allows a survivor to look at the offender and say, this is what has happened to my life because of what you did to me. You know, my marriage broke up. I no longer felt safe. I didn't feel comfortable dating anymore. I'm a different person. my family broke up over it, all the ripples, as we call it, that occur as a result of a sexual assault. And there are ripples. The deep impact of an assault changes people's lives, and they talk about their life before and their life after. So she can tell him that, look him in the face, tell him that. She then can ask him questions. Who are you? Why, if it's a stranger assault, why did you pick me out? What, you know, where I was, what I was wearing, why did you pick my apartment? Because there's a lot of fear that the offender is going to come back and attack, and that's rarely the case, but the victim has those fears. Then the victim will say, well, tell me about your life. Tell me how you grew up. Have you done this before? And then she will move into, what have you been doing in prison since you got here? Have you been in program? You know, because okay. The victims have a deep desire that the offender not recommit an offense against someone else.
Jeanine Geske, we need to take a break here, but we will continue our conversation after the news. Jeanine Geske, retired Marquette University Law School professor and former Justice of the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Where the traditional justice system fails victims of sexual assault, a newer approach called restorative justice can succeed. That's according to our guest, who's helped expand it in Wisconsin and beyond. We're talking about how it works, and we're learning about its intangible effect on survivors. What do you think our traditional justice system misses when addressing sexual abuse? What can it do better? How should it change? And do you see this process of restorative justice as being helpful? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email, and you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jeanine Geske is a retired Marquette University Law School professor, former director of the Marquette Law School's Restorative Justice Initiative, was previously a justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court and a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge. Jeanine, before we broke for news, you were telling us about the advantages or the things that a restorative justice program can offer that the regular justice system cannot. I please finish that thought, and then sure. We'll continue our discussion.
One of the things that happens often in a courtroom, if an offender has pled guilty, is that often the offender quickly says some kind of apology to the victim. That apology frequently falls on deaf ears because everybody's assuming that the defendant's saying that to get a better deal from the judge. And so victims don't really put too much stock in those. In a face-to-face meeting, an offender, if he is truly sorry or she's sorry, they can express that often through tears, often talking about now recognizing the kind of harm that was caused. And that can be very meaningful to a victim. Some victims come into restorative justice processes wanting to forgive the offender. They think that that's part of their journey. Others do not. And I always tell them, you know, wait till you see the offender and listen to him or her and make that decision, because forgiveness means things to different people. But we have on a number of occasions had cases both in sexual assaults or in homicides where a victim at the end of the meeting will actually hug the offender, or at least say, I forgive you, or we'll say things like, I wish I could forgive you today, I'm not ready yet. And to be able to have those very intimate, safe discussions with an offender truly, truly impacts the victim. I've never had a victim go through one of these and say, I was sorry I went through it. They all have some amount of healing after they've had an open opportunity in a safe environment to have that kind of discussion.
And is this process limited to survivors whose abusers have actually been convicted?
Well, that's where most of the cases come from. So there are cases, for example, and we heard about one a few weeks ago with Justice Kavanaugh, where cases are not reported or cases are not brought to court. The question is whether the offender, if you can find him or her or know who he is, you have to get consent to do this, and they have to admit something, they did something. And but it doesn't have to have gone through the court process. And if you can think of an example, perhaps on campus or in a school setting where there's a lesser degree, where it isn't a full-fledged sexual assault, but maybe uncomfortable behavior or something, those are really appropriate for a victim to be able to tell an offender the impact. And people are truly impacted when they hear those stories, not realizing that they've hurt somebody so deeply. We did some restorative justice circles, which is another process on unsportsmanlike behavior. And some female athletes were telling some male athletes from another school that when somebody yells that they're fat while they're playing basketball, that some of those girls develop anorexia or bulimia based on those taunts. And, and a student of color being able to say, being called a racist name from the stands, and how that impacts him, it really can infect people who hear that and make them think before they engage in that behavior again.
So you have been, you're retired, but or at least partially, but you still spend a lot of your time on restorative justice. Why do you care so deeply about this line of work?
My husband laughs that now I work full-time for free. I love this work. It really, for me, there's a spiritual base. It's just, for me, I don't inject my religion or my faith. But there is incredible transformational, for me, there's a spiritual oversight on this, that I have seen such amazing things happen. I've worked with amazing survivors, the strength that they have. I mean, I had one man whose daughter was killed in a drunk driving. She was a student at UW, and he came in and said to me that he wanted to meet with the offender because he wanted to make his life better, because he wanted to give meaning to his daughter's death. And I think, would I ever be in those shoes? And so to be able to have people like that meet the offender and have those discussions is really very powerful. And the international and national studies on crimes generally, often smaller crimes, is that these processes, in fact, do reduce the amount of recidivism, increase victim satisfaction with the system, and also increases the amount of restitution that ultimately gets paid. The United States is behind the time on doing this. These processes are occurring all over the world. I actually went to Iran a couple years ago to a conference on restorative justice. It's in the European Union documents, it's in the UN documents, and these processes are being used in lots and lots of cultures in order to heal, in order to have some healing. We know that just jailing somebody may protect the public for a period of time, but it doesn't get to the heart of what we need to do, which is have offenders understand the harm and to be able to heal the victims.
It sounds like restorative justice has a very therapeutic effect on survivors, but you're very careful not to call it therapy. Why is that?
Well, I'm not a therapist, and so I'm not doing therapy. In fact, especially in sexual assault cases, I always inquire as to whether the victim has been through therapy. I'd like to talk to the therapist. I prefer, if I can, to have the therapist engaged in the process. We provide a process that we listen, that we support a victim in talking to him or her about what happened, and to be able to go through this process, we are the facilitator. But we're not looking at the deep psychological. I mean, I can see some of the changes that happen, but I'm not there to try to push those or to decide what's best for a victim. But I have to say, you know, not only has every victim that I've worked with been happy with her process, or at least felt that it did some good, every offender has also given me that feedback, that some of them say it is the most important thing that they've ever engaged in. You know, they can't believe the victim's willing to listen to them, and they really do feel like they're helping to heal some harm by be willing to sit in this very difficult conversation.
More colleges are looking at restorative justice as a way to address sexual assault. Betsy DeVos, U.S. Education Secretary, has shown support for alternative approaches to handling those cases. Do you see this as a positive change?
Well, it's a positive change to be talking about it. I'm concerned that we don't get in a place where we're forcing victims to have this as an alternative to the court system. First of all, a lot of offenders just need to go through the court system for supervision purposes to make sure that, you know, that others survive, that other victims are not being developed. But and so I think that when I think that some of the Department of Education was looking, well, maybe we could have restorative justice instead of a formal disciplinary process. And a lot of us in the field are very concerned about that.
Okay.
First of all, if you're doing it really quickly after the crime, often the victim is still very traumatized.
We're about out of time here. For those interested in learning more about restorative justice, very quickly, where can they find more information?
Well, the primary office that takes in requests is the Wisconsin Department of Corrections Victim Services.
Okay.
People can email me at Marquette, Janine.Geske@Marquette.edu, and I'd be happy to answer
questions. Okay, and we'll have to leave it there. Janine Geske, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you. My pleasure.
Janine Geske, retired Marquette University Law School professor, former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Well, in case you missed it, the midterm elections are just weeks away. And as part of our continuing coverage, we're talking to people running for Congress in Wisconsin. Today, we're focusing on Wisconsin's 3rd District. Congressman Ron Kind has represented Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District since 1996. He's the Democrat in this race. Congressman Kind, welcome to The Morning Show.
Hey, good morning, John. Go Brewers.
Go Brewers. Yeah, they have some work to do now.
First off, why
are you running for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District?
Well, first of all, John, I was born and raised here in La Crosse. My father was a telephone repairman. I was a special prosecutor before running for Congress. My wife, Tawny's from Cumberland. We raised our two boys here, Johnny and Matt, in western Wisconsin. But no, I just think our political system's broken. It's way too polarized. It's way too hyper-partisan. Shouldn't have to be this hard. And I feel that, having been there for a little bit, I'm in a unique position to try to heal the rift that's developed in our democracy. I think I've developed some trust and credibility across the aisle. I was recently ranked the 2nd most independent member, the 4th most bipartisan member of the entire Congress out of 435, because I've been willing to get in the same room with my colleagues and listen to them and work hard to find common ground. And we need that now more than ever in Washington, in Madison, at all levels of government, people who start listening and respecting each other a little bit more, so we can get things done on behalf of the people we represent.
You've been in Congress now for over 20 years. Some might say you can point to that experience as a strength. Others, including your opponent, Steve Toft, use it to refer to you as a career politician. Make the case that your tenure is a positive and not a negative.
Well, you know, Congress is a complicated place, and you have to be there a little bit to develop the relationships you need and the trust you need in order to work across the aisle, which I think is essential in our democracy. But I also believe that we desperately need to restore some checks and balances in Washington and also in Madison. One-party control of government is not healthy for any democracy, and it's been that way since 2010 in both Washington and Madison. And I think if we get some divided government again, which I hope we will this November, you'll see more oversight, more accountability, more transparency to government, and rather than a Congress that's merely complicit with everything that this president is doing. And I'm looking for opportunities to work with President Trump, too. I hope we can move forward on an infrastructure investment for our state and our country and start rebuilding Wisconsin the way it should. But I will also push back against his darker tendencies and make sure that Congress is a co-equal branch rather than a branch of government that's merely complicit with everything his administration is doing.
Let's talk about some specific issues in this campaign. When Congress wrapped its session this summer, it did so while leaving behind quite a few unanswered questions on things like immigration. So when the next Congress convenes next year, immigration likely going to be one of the most pressing issues on the table. How do you think we need to proceed here?
Well, we need to do it comprehensively. As I've been traveling around Wisconsin, you know, this fall, especially getting feedback from people, I just had a meeting with a lot of farmers on that, and they're very anxious about the state of our immigration policy. I mean, they do rely on migrant labor in order to keep their operations going. And I think most people back home want to take a comprehensive approach, similar to what the Senate did a few years ago with wide bipartisan buy-in and support. Unfortunately, the Republican leadership in the House refused to even bring that legislation up for a debate and for a vote. So if we're in the majority next January, John, I'm one of those voices pushing for reforming the way work gets done in Congress. So it is more respectful to the minority party, but that bipartisan bills have a chance to come to the floor and be considered, and that everything isn't done out of the Speaker's office, top down, and being run like a parliamentary system where the party members are expected to vote in lockstep with everything that their leadership is doing. So we've got to change that. We've got to have more members going to Congress who are willing to stand up to the powerful special interests, but also to the political leadership in both parties when you think what they're doing is wrong for the people you represent.
Let's also talk about health care. During the last session, we saw a failed attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act, followed by changes to the law. In your view, what needs to happen with the ACA and maybe broadly in health care policy in general?
Well, we need to mend it, not end it. It's not perfect, but it's doing also a lot of good, including the protections for people with pre-existing conditions, which is in jeopardy right now with that federal court case in Texas, which unfortunately our governor has joined. But I'd like to see us strengthen the health insurance exchanges. There are more options and more competition, which can help bring prices down. But you also need to step on the gas when it comes to delivery system reform, how healthcare is delivered, so it's based more on the models that exist in Wisconsin, more integrated, more patient-centered and coordinated type of care. And I've been one of the leading voices in pushing for payment reform in healthcare. So we're paying for the value or the quality of care that's given, no longer the number of tests, procedures, and things that are done to us, regardless of results. I think that has a transformative potential effect throughout the healthcare system. But I'd certainly like to see us tee up prescription drug reform. There's no reason why the federal government can't use our bargaining leverage to negotiate better prices, bulk rate purchases, for instance, like we do in the VA system, cross-border purchases with Canada, as long as safety concerns are addressed, because prescription drug costs are one of the major cost drivers in the healthcare system, and nothing is happening in Washington to address that.
This week, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that the only way to lower the federal deficit, which he also said isn't a Republican problem, would be to cut social safety net programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Is that something you'd be willing to accept?
Well, first of all, I voted against that fiscally irresponsible and foolish tax bill that was recently enacted, where 83% of the benefit goes to big companies and the wealthiest 1%. There were no offsets. It wasn't paid for. It's going to add $2.3 trillion to our national debt. So get this. We're going to be delivering huge tax breaks to the wealthiest 1%, borrowing $2.3 trillion from China, leaving that price tag off to our children and grandchildren, and hope it produces some miraculous revenue recovery, which we aren't seeing. Recent reports show that we're at $800 billion in deficits this year. It's going to go over $1 trillion next year. I don't want that now to be the excuse where they pivot and start talking about huge cuts to Social Security, Medicare, which they were proposing in their most recent budget. That is not a fair deal for Wisconsinites. And we're going to need to simplify and reform the tax code, but make it fair for working families and make it fiscally responsible by shutting down tax loopholes that huge real estate moguls like the Trump family are able to take advantage of and not pay any taxes at all for years. The only thing that makes our revenue system work, John, is this belief that everyone's paying their fair share. And when more stories come out that the uber wealthy are paying virtually nothing, people lose confidence then in our revenue system and the tax code. And we need to figure out a way to restore that confidence.
Bringing it back to Wisconsin, what do you think is one of the biggest issues affecting your district, the 3rd District, and how do you think you can address it in Congress?
Well, there are still pockets of the economic recovery that have left areas behind. I see that a lot in rural America. The farm economy is down. It has been the last 3 years with low commodity prices. The president's trade war, the retaliatory tariffs have not helped with farm prices. I recently authored a bill that was enacted into law that will create opportunity zones to get early-stage capital in these economically distressed areas, especially in rural Wisconsin and throughout rural America. You know, that first-stage capital is crucial to support entrepreneurship, new businesses, or perhaps businesses that want to expand their operation. It could be used for infrastructure or broadband expansion. So I was trying to think out of the box of how can we light a fire in these pockets that are being left behind by the economic recovery. And we have many of those right here in Wisconsin. So I've been leading in, trying to get that implemented here in Wisconsin. And I really try to spur parts of our state that hasn't seen the type of economic recovery that we'd like to see.
America is a pretty divided country right now. Congress, certainly no exception to that. Many votes in the last session fallen, as you point out, more or less down party lines. How do you shift that narrative so that Congress can actually maybe get more things done? I mean, if you look at how many bills were passed, the current Congress makes Harry Truman's do-nothing Congress look like real go-getters. So what's the future of bipartisanship in Congress as far as you're concerned?
You have to bring an attitude of cooperation and compromise. I tell people I approach my job the same way I do with my family. If I came home one night, John, and told Tawny, my wife, I've got a great new idea on how decisions are going to be made in this family. It's going to be my way or no way at all. She'd throw me out by my ears. She wouldn't tolerate that for a second. Why are so many representatives bringing that attitude with them to Madison or to Washington? It shouldn't be this way. Our founders, in their infinite wisdom, put a lot of checks and balances in place that forces the type of cooperation and compromise to get things done. And it's not. And we need to change that. Again, the 3rd most independent member, I've shown a willingness to get in the same room. I've been leading this group called the New Dem Coalition. I instituted a monthly bipartisan lunch with a group of more pragmatic House Republicans, the Tuesday group, just to get everyone in the same room together, talking and listening and getting to know each other a little bit better. And when we were doing that, we're finding areas of overlap that we can work on together. Again, those are some of the changes that we need, both in Washington and Madison these days.
All right, Congressman Kind, I think that'll do it. We're about out of time, so thank you very much for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, John. Go Brewers. We can do it.
Okay. Congressman Ron Kind represents Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. He's the Democratic candidate in this race. We will be talking with his Republican challenger, Steve Toft, tomorrow at this same time. For more information about the candidates in the race and other information useful to voters, you can go online to wisconsinvote.org, wisconsinvote.org. If you have trouble remembering that, we do have links to it on our website, WPR.org. A little shorter, but I think we should all be able to remember WisconsinVote.org, don't you? I'm John Munson. I can remember that. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.